Coming up, digital addiction. Kim Lawton looks at how it may be harming relationships and what some faith traditions are urging people to do about it. And radio talk show host Diane Rehm won the so-called Right to Die and on her new book, On My Own. Plus, belief and practice. In preparation for Passover, Jews get rid of all foods that are not kosher during the holiday.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. The global refugee crisis took yet another tragic turn this week. United Nations officials say as many as 500 migrants trying to reach Europe may have drowned in the Mediterranean Sea. Survivors said their ship sank after human traffickers tried to cram more people onto an already overcrowded boat. It was the worst sea incident in more than a year. Meanwhile, Pope Francis issued an apology to refugees for what he called the closure and indifference of our societies. He has repeatedly urged nations and churches to take in migrants and refugees. Last week, he followed his own advice, bringing 12 Syrian refugees back to Italy with him after his one-day visit to Greece. The three families received a warm welcome from the Roman Catholic charity that is helping them. The families called the Pope's gesture a miracle. Humanitarian groups are praising Francis and Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew for focusing international attention on the migrant crisis during last Saturday's visit to Lesbos. The two leaders and the Orthodox Archbishop of Greece met with migrants, held a prayer service, and threw wreaths into the sea in remembrance of those who've died on the journey to Greece. The religious leaders also issued a joint declaration calling on the international community to take stronger action in the crisis and to make protection of human lives a priority. Last weekend's massive earthquake in Ecuador has killed more than 500 people and injured more than 2,500. Pope Francis said his prayers are with the victims of the tragedy. Meanwhile, U.S. faith-based humanitarian relief agencies are on the ground. World Vision, a Christian aid agency, is providing emergency relief items such as mattresses, mosquito nets, and hygiene supplies to thousands in the hardest hit areas. Six nuns, all members of the Servant Sisters of the Home of the Mother, were among those killed in the quake. Hundreds of immigration advocates, many from religious groups, marched outside the Supreme Court Monday as the justices heard a challenge to President Obama's plan that would shield millions of undocumented immigrants from deportation. The suit objecting to the plan was brought by 26 states. The justices appear to be sharply divided, and a 4-4 deadlock may be a real possibility. That would leave in place an appeals court ruling that blocks the plan known as DAPA. Many religious activists urged the court to uphold the plan.
Anyone who's a devotee of the Abrahamic religions know that the ones we're supposed to reach out to, the widow, the orphan, the stranger. And yet, somehow we've forgotten about that.
Mississippi Governor Phil Bryant has signed into law what's called the Church Protection Act. The legislation allows places of worship to designate certain members to carry guns into church buildings and gives them legal protections. It also allows people to carry holstered weapons without a permit. The legislation was a response to last year's massacre at a historic African-American church in Charleston, South Carolina, that left 9 people dead. Jordan's prime minister has called off a plan to install surveillance cameras at Jerusalem's Temple Mount. The plan, brokered by U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, was meant to ease tensions after clashes between Palestinian protesters and Israeli security forces. Muslims also revere the holy site, calling it the Noble Sanctuary. Under a decades-old arrangement, Jews are allowed to visit the Temple Mount, but not to pray there. Now, what some say is a growing social affliction, digital addiction. From computers to smartphones and tablets, the pervasiveness of digital devices in American society has brought many benefits, but it also raises several ethical issues. Today, Kim Lawton looks at how frequent use of digital devices may be harming social and family relationships. She also found faith traditions urging people to re-examine how and how often they use their devices.
It's Friday night in San Francisco. These people are heading for a lively night on the town, and they're doing something many would find unthinkable. They're checking their phones at the door. This is the National Day of Unplugging, launched 7 years ago by the Jewish nonprofit group Reboot. The goal is to encourage people to take a break from technology and find other ways to entertain themselves. For many, that's easier said than done.
I leave without my phone. I feel like I'm driving in a car without a seatbelt on.
I check my email all the time. I was doing it before.
She was. We were in another bar, and she's checking her email for work still, and it's 7:30 at night on a Friday.
So it's good. This is an excuse to just leave the phone behind.
It's like a security blanket, in a way, for me. Like, if I don't have it when I go out the door of my home, I feel kind of vulnerable.
There was a time where you would go out, and you would not know what happens in the world for that time you went out. So why has that changed? I guess we're just addicted to the constant stream of I'm knowing what's happening at all times.
At National Day of Unplugging events like this one, people have fun doing non-digital activities, from knitting and coloring to writing notes the old-fashioned way. There's face painting, live music, and even a photo booth.
We ask people to think about what they like to do when they're unplugged. You know, so many people say, oh, I could never put down my cell phone. I wouldn't be able to live without it. But in reality, there's so many things we like to do when we're unplugged.
Reboot spokesperson Tanya Shevitz says it's not anti-technology, but rather urging people to find a better balance in how they use technology. She says the concept comes from the Jewish Sabbath, Shabbat, a regular time set aside for rest.
It's ancient wisdom that is ever more important right now in our hyper-connected world, in a world where we are on 24/7, where there's this expectation that you can be reached and that you will respond to every buzz, beep, vibration, and ping of your phone or your digital devices. So I think it's needed more than ever, really.
Americans are increasingly dependent on their digital devices. According to the Pew Research Center, 92% of U.S. adults own cell phones, and almost 70% of those are smartphones. About three-quarters of Americans own a computer, and nearly half own some kind of tablet. While this has undeniable benefits, many analysts say the negative impact must also be addressed.
The latest study shows that 89% of Americans took out a phone during their last social interaction, and 82% say that it deteriorated the conversation. That's my concern, that we're deteriorating our presence and in-person presence.
Psychologist and Massachusetts Institute of Technology professor Sherry Turkle is author of Reclaiming Conversation, The Power of Talk in a Digital Age. She argues that the near constant distractions of technology can harm many aspects of relationships.
All the things that we get out of conversation, intimacy, empathy, our ability to connect with other people and know them and form relationships, because we're always elsewhere in some way at the same time.
She argues that a deterioration of personal connections has troubling consequences for the entire society.
When something becomes the social norm, we become desensitized. We say, well, that's just the way it is. But that doesn't mean that it doesn't do its damage. And it is particularly damaging to young people, to the children we're raising.
In his recent document on the family, Pope Francis also noted that technology can hurt families, such as, quote, when at dinner time everyone is surfing on a mobile phone, or when one spouse falls asleep waiting for the other, who spends hours playing with an electronic device. For the National Day of Unplugging, Tanishevitz organizes non-digital events for adults and children as well. She says she was taken aback by one recent interaction with a father.
He said, oh my gosh, we really need this. And he turned to his daughter, who was about five, and said, who's mommy's best friend? And without hesitation, this little girl said, her cell phone. And I mean, my gosh, that's just heartbreaking. I wouldn't want my kids saying that.
Still, Shevitz admits unplugging is something that she struggles with as well. She puts her phone away when she picks up her kids from school and tries not to be on it again until they go to bed.
They know that they're going to get my attention when I pick them up from school, that I'm not going to be, you know, only half listening, or I'm going to be glancing at my phone or checking Facebook. They know that I'm going to listen to what they have to say, that I'm going to play with them.
Many experts are also concerned that people use digital devices as a way to avoid being alone with their thoughts.
You can see that anxiety about being alone, you know, when you look at people at a checkout line in a supermarket, and I study people at stop signs. I mean, they're supposed to wait for 4 seconds. At 3 seconds, they're checking their texts.
As a Zen master and guiding teacher at the Cambridge Zen Center in Massachusetts, Jane Dobish believes there are great spiritual benefits to being still and being in the present moment. She finds help in the ancient Buddhist practice of meditation.
That's what meditation addresses, is that this moment is so rich. It's so wonderful if you can just stop running away from it. Take the breath, take a rest, settle into the moment, and then hear the sound of the bird. Feel the wind on your cheek, smell the flower, you know, feel your body, feel your heart.
Dobish leads device-free meditation retreats for college students.
They're told in the beginning of the day, no phones, and you can't check your phone during the break or anything. And they are so happy. At the end of that day, it's just 9 to 3. It's not like a huge commitment. They are so happy.
She says they're amazed at their heightened awareness of the world around them.
And it's a revelation for them that they could see the flower, you know? Because you can't see the flower if you're doing this.
Well, I feel we're at a moment where we've adopted a new technology. We've been vulnerable to its seduction. And we're also ready to say this has not led us to a good place in terms of how it's affected our relationships. It's time for a change.
Professor Terkel says one of society's ethical priorities should be carving out what she calls sacred spaces, where conversation and relationships are given more importance than technology.
Empathy is at stake. And we need empathy to raise children who are able to be ethical and moral people.
But given all the new digital gadgets flooding the market, the challenges to doing that may only get greater. I'm Kim Lawton reporting.
There's a wrenching debate underway about the treatment of the terminally ill. Many voices, some of them deeply religious, strongly oppose helping anyone end his or her life. Others approve it. In June, California becomes the fifth state to allow terminally ill patients to end their life with the help of a doctor's prescription. We spoke about end-of-life treatment with NPR host Diane Rehm, who has written a book, On My Own, about her family's struggle with the issue. Rehm's husband, John, died in 2014 after a long battle with Parkinson's disease. Toward the end of his illness, he asked his doctor to help him die.
John began the conversation by saying to the doctor, Dr. Fried, I can no longer stand, I can no longer feed myself, I can no longer do anything for myself, and frankly, this is a life not worth living. I am ready to die. The doctor said very simply, John, I do understand your feelings, and I honor your feelings, but in the state of Maryland, I am forbidden from in any way helping you morally, ethically, any other way. I cannot help you. My daughter on the phone said, but Dad, we can keep you comfortable. And he said, I do not want comfort. John was a very proud man. And for the prior 6 months or so, he had had to have somebody there constantly to do things for him, to help him bathe, to help him move from bed to bathroom, help him eat. And he said, I am falling into further and further degradation. And I don't want to go any further. So comfort was certainly not what he was after.
On June 14th, 2014, John Rehm began to refuse any food or drink. He died 10 days later. After her husband's death, Diane continued to host The Diane Rehm Show. She faced criticism for speaking publicly about her support for the Death with Dignity movement. Diane now discloses her support for the movement when the topic is discussed on her show.
It wasn't until an article in the Washington Post came out with the headline, Rehm Becomes Outspoken Advocate for the Right to Die. The word advocate was what everybody picked up on, when in fact, I had simply gone to speak of my own experience. I am not suggesting, nor would John ever have suggested, that his way out is the way for everyone. I think what we both believe is that there should be choice, and that if one chooses palliative care, if one says, my God has said to me, when my time comes, my time will come, according to his, her will. I think that's beautiful. I think I face each day with a brightness of spirit and optimism, the knowledge that not only my book, but John's death, Brittany Maynard's death, the death of hundreds of other people in Oregon who have chosen the way they wish to die, that will bring the whole subject into family homes. People need to talk about this issue. Doctors need to be taught about this issue. The whole idea of doctors being taught about helping to keep people alive, but not being taught how to listen to those who are ready to die. That seems to me sad and misguided.
On our calendar, Jews have begun the 8-day observance of Passover when they remember their ancestors' exodus from Egypt. According to the biblical story, God commanded the Jews to leave Egypt before their bread had time to rise. So, for Passover, Jews traditionally eat an unleavened bread called matzah. During the entire 8 days, Jewish law prohibits Jews from consuming or even possessing leavened items such as breads, cakes, and pasta. which are known as Hametz. Rabbi Yosef Landa of Chabad.org explains how many Jews rid their homes of Hametz for the Passover holiday.
There are many ways that you can rid your home of Hametz. You can consume it. You can give it to a friend. You can donate it to a charity. You could sell it. You can destroy it, which is actually something which we symbolically do. We actually do take pieces of Hametz that we have, which we search the house for the night before, which is another one of the procedures that we do in preparation of our homes in observance of Passover, is to search for the Hametz. And then we find these pieces of Hametz, and in the morning before Passover, we make a fire, or some people come together and make a fire together, and destroy the Hametz, symbolically giving expression to this commandment that the Torah instructs us to rid our homes, to rid ourselves from possession of chametz.
Any chametz or leaven that is in my possession, whether I have recognized it or not, whether I have seen it or not, whether I have removed it or not, should be annulled and become ownerless like the dust of the earth.
Jews have been observing Passover and the prohibition of chametz for 3,300 years. And so this system was developed over the years, selling of the chametz.
Welcome.
The person who is in possession of the chametz and wants to get rid of it for the holiday goes to the rabbi and authorizes the rabbi, I want you to do the sale for me when Passover comes. It's a power of attorney. The objects that are being sold remain in your home, but the ownership of those objects is transferred over to someone else. You signed a document or you lifted this cloth together with the rabbi, which is symbolic of effectuating the authorization. But for many people, that's not possible. They don't know a rabbi. They don't have a rabbi. The rabbi is too far away from them. They don't have any time. Their schedule doesn't permit it. Whatever the reason might be, for them, there is the online sales where people actually fill out the form online. There's no paper involved. They click, sell my chametz for me. It's available in all languages. They choose the time zone that they're in that's closest to them for the purpose of making sure that it's sold at the proper time, because the prohibition against possession of the chametz kicks in on the sixth hour of the day. So I pass along this agency, this power of agency, which I receive from the seller. I pass it along to these other rabbis for them to sell it at their location in the time zone where they are. In this way, at each location, wherever the person may be living, the chametz is sold at the proper time in that specific location. So it's a wonderful, wonderful coming together of an ancient, ancient tradition with the most modern, up-to-date methodologies. Then on the morning before Passover, the rabbi sits down with this non-Jewish buyer. I try to find an individual who will understand what it is that's taking place. We have a prep session. We actually sit down and I explain to him exactly what we're doing and why we're doing it, and his role in all of that. It's an actual contract. The document that we use is a very traditional document, which is actually written in Hebrew, but we offer the non-Jew an English translation so he can familiarize himself with whatever is in that document. This is not a fictitious sale. This is a genuine, bona fide transfer of ownership, which is legitimate and valid by Jewish law as well as by civil law. And after the holiday, you buy it back. It's a new transaction. You buy the chametz back from the non-Jew. Non-Jew makes a little bit on it in terms of a profit.
Okay. Very good. We have a deal, don't we?
Yes, we do.
Absolutely.
People who don't share our faith are helping Jewish people in the observance of their faith.
Finally, also on our calendar, for the world's Eastern Orthodox Christians, this coming week is Holy Week, leading up to Easter or Pascha on May 1st. Eastern and Western Christians use different calendars to determine when Easter falls every year. Sometimes those dates coincide, but more often than not, Easter is celebrated on different days in the two traditions. And sometimes, like this year, those days are more than a month apart. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook And watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. There's much more on our website. Join us at pbs.org/religionethics. As we leave you, abolitionist Harriet Tubman's favorite hymn, Swing Low, Sweet Chariot. This week, the Treasury Department announced that Tubman's image will replace Andrew Jackson's on the $20 bill. She was a devout Christian who helped free hundreds of
coming for to carry me.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.